Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. This has been going on since 1982, and most Sunday nights at 8 p.m. on W2BL, you can hear us do our little thing from about 8 to approximately 11 p.m. As always, I want to remind everyone before we really begin that if you have any questions and you can't get on to the technical net, or if you have any topics you would like to hear discussed or puzzles you'd like me to share with the audience, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a YouTube video or a news item or any bits and pieces of the space, NASA and other things going on, and discuss it. The email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. As always, I have a bunch of links available on a web page. Often they allude to conversations had during the technical net. Otherwise, it's time that I've links that I've found interesting in the previous week. There are some very interesting horological links because I just purchased a wristwatch and was curious about a bunch of things. So if you want to read some interesting articles on state-of-the-art watch design, or I saw an interesting YouTube that also goes into detail about how optical anti-reflection coatings work. And if you remember back to Andy WA2CDL's discussion of impedances and such, he alluded to that. So that's interesting as well. You can find all those links and previous links at my webpage, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. Let me break for a sec. Okay, as always, we have a chat room available to anyone inclined. Sometimes chat room conversation runs parallel to what's going on the TechNet. Other times they find topics to amuse them that's not exactly related in real time to what's going on in the TechNet. But if you're curious or interested, you can either go to the Limark webpage and follow the links to the chat room, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you directly to the initial page to get onto the chat room. As always, I try to stream audio from this technical net for those people who don't have access to a link, either direct RF in the neighborhood, or IRLP or Echo Link. So anyone out there who can't use any of the usual radio equipment, you can just use your browser, type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a link that you can listen to the audio stream as it sounds to me here in good old Brooklyn, New York. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, AC2NJI, maintains a great archive of the technical net that goes as far back as September 2006. So, there are great pearls of wisdom from the likes of Dick, K2RIW, who's a silent key, who ran this for 30-plus years, 38. Avail yourself of that. There was Melt, and there was Eric, and there was John. They were all great guys, and they had a lot to share, and they still share it in the form of the archive. So please check out amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a sec. I like to tell people approximately what we have planned for you all tonight. And as I always mentioned, participants make or break the technical net. If you bring interesting topics or questions or comments, it makes for a very stimulating technical net. If you just sit back and listen, well, who knows what will come of it. So we're going to start, as we always do, with questions of a technical nature. I'll ask you to check in and give us your first name and your call sign, and we'll take people in order as best we can. Unfortunately, Andy, WA2CDL, will not be with us tonight with another episode of Andy's Corner. Perhaps he will be back next Sunday for one. We look forward to and hope that that's the case. At around 10:15, give or take, I will call upon Paul, WS2N, to bring us the space report. And that should take us to about 11 o'clock, and we'll tie a bow on it and wish you all a safe and a happy week until we speak again. So that's the plan. We'll see what the reality is. This, again, is AC2GS, and my name is Roy. And if you have a question or a topic or a comment for the technical net tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
K2RY, David. November 2, Zulu Charlie John.
Roger, Roger, this is KC2QYW, Joe from Harrison, New York. Back to you.
Okay, David, John, and Joe recognized. Anyone else want to sign up for tonight?
Rich, W2BZ. W2BZ.
Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, very good. David, you're up first, KG2RY.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everyone. It took me about 2.5-3 months to get this nanospot to work on the MMDVM hotspot. And I run two hotspots side by side, one for DMR duplex hotspot, and one for D-Star, D-Star hotspot. They both take signal from my Wi-Fi. My question for you, Roy, if you can answer, why is it that when I want to access the control panel for Pi-Star, that the IP address changes for each of the devices, you know? Sometimes I can get in, and then for some reason the IP address changes, and I have to find out what the IP address is so I can get access to either of the two devices on the Pi-Star control panel. Do you have any word on that?
Well, I don't have a lot of experience with Pi-Star itself. As I've mentioned before, I tend to use OpenSpot, which is a little bit different. I did have a good friend, Ham, lend me his Pi-Star for a couple of months, so I played around with it. I think what you're kind of butting heads with is the concept between the IP address. Every device has a local IP device to identify itself on your private little network. And what happens is there's two different types of IP addresses. There are static IP addresses in which you basically assign it a specific IP address. And unfortunately, there is also something called a dynamic IP address in which one of your machines, it could be your router, it could be a server, takes any kind of random request and gives it an acceptable IP address for a certain period of time. The dynamic IP can last a day or 2 days or a month or 2 months. It sort of depends upon how the dynamic IP server is implemented. So I think what's happening is that you're simply running a dynamic IP on your Pi-Star as opposed to a static IP. If you could Google it, you could find out if there's a way to set each of your Pi-Stars to a specific IP address in a static form so that it will never change.
Well, QSL, Roy, I use a program called Fing, F-I-N-G, and it identifies the IP address of each of these devices changing maybe from day to day. So I guess that's what it is, a dynamic IP address. And if I want to gain access to it, you know, I have to run Fing and I have to scan the network, and then I get the new IP address, then I get access to the control panel.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's always an option, and I have applications on a lot of my iPad and iPhone devices that are basically IP snippers, they're called. What they do is they sniff through the wireless network. They kind of ping the entire 256 possible IP addresses of my private IP subclass and give me an approximate idea of what's on what IP address. You can do it that way, but again, you can probably also just by Googling, you'll get a much more, more thorough visual presentation of how to get to the screen where you can change the settings of your PhiStar from a dynamic IP to a static IP. And then you could choose whatever IP address as long as it doesn't match any other device in your house. The beauty of the dynamic IP server is that it takes a kind of inventory of available free IP addresses, and it only assigns it so that you don't get collision. If you have two devices with the same exact IP address, you get IP collisions that causes all kinds of error comments, and one device will be blocked for a moment and then free and then blocked. So you could either do it the way you're doing it, that's fine, or you can change it to a static IP address and not have to worry about that anymore.
I'll look into it, but I think dynamic IP address is okay. And this is just okay. You know, these little circuit boards, you know, it's quite amazing what they can do. You can even hook up screens to them through USB. So you can see what action is there before you turn the radio on, which is kind of nice. Thank you very much, Roy.
You're welcome, David, and I wish you good luck with it. Again, both methods work. The reason why you're able to visualize things, most likely, is because most of the hotspots available are based on a Raspberry Pi. There are different versions of Raspberry Pi up there. I think the latest and greatest is the 4 Series Raspberry Pi. There's also, I've been kind of hawking, they're coming up with a enclosed keyboard, so it's like a little computer. All you need to do is supply the monitor. It's called the Raspberry Pi 400. It hasn't been really released yet, but when it is, it'll go for $70, which is pretty good for that kind of medium strength. You know, as far as a computer, it certainly won't do the things that your present Mac or your IBM PC type. But it certainly does a lot. So, yeah, the 400 has the capability of outputting to two 4,000 4K monitors, which strikes me as still amazing because, you know, there are some old PCs out there that can't do that. So enjoy your hotspots. And anyone out there who's interested in playing around with inexpensive computers, I often recommend Raspberry Pi in general, and especially if you don't like the problems of getting a case for it and fitting it in things and having wires dangling about, consider the Raspberry Pi 400. It's a nice little self-contained keyboard with a computer stuck into it. So that's my 2 cents for the Raspberry Pi 400. Thank you very much, David. Anyone else have any comments on this subject before we move on to the next person?
Headlight 2H.
Yes, I heard Lou. Someone was doubling with Lou. Who was doubling with Lou?
Rich, W2BZ.
Okay, we'll go to Lou first. We'll go to you second, Rich. So, Lou, what's your words of wisdom?
Yeah, good evening, all. Dave may be able to do that in his router. Some routers allow you to Hold on one second. All right. Some routers allow you to dedicate a device to a particular LAN IP address. And if it doesn't, sometimes you can set the DHCP address range in your LAN, so you can say go from like .10 to .25, and those will be randomly selected, and then the device itself prescribe an address outside that range, and that is another way to get a dedicated static LAN IP. So he should look into his router. He may be able to do it right there if it's if it has address reservation capability.
Okay, that's a good idea, Lou. It really depends on what access, where the active DHCP is running on his network. A lot of people, it does run on the router. Some routers are rather flexible in what they can do. I always like to go to the root of the problem, though, and I'm almost sure, I mean, I'm sure you can Google it much faster than I can, but that PiStar has that capability of shifting from a dynamic IP address to a static IP address. Because I've sort of done it with a lot of my, especially amateur radio equipment. They like to make it kind of idiot-proof, so they enable DHCP all over the place, and then I have to unenable it because I prefer to have static addresses in my chat.
Yeah, and in that regard, if he can do it on PiStar, he probably still additionally has to get that out of the dynamically available addresses. In other words, usually again on the router, you can specify a range of addresses it can choose from. So that would avoid a collision, I guess. Not sure if that'd be a problem or not, but that might be a second step. All righty, I think he's got enough to work with there. All right, back to net.
Okay, very good, Lou. Rich, W2BZ, you wanted to say something on the subject.
Yes, first of all, can you hear me? Because you're about 20% to 30% noise.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. You're sounding good.
Okay, I missed the part. Was the questioner saying that he was running two hotspots at the same time?
Yes, he was mentioning two hotspots. It really, I don't think, adds to the situation where it's just a matter of two devices set up to dynamically pull off an IP address. It's just pulling off random IP addresses.
But doesn't, I may be wrong, but don't you have to assign an IP address in PiStar? And by the way, for people who are scratching their heads, we're talking about, I think we're talking about DMR, digital radio. Go ahead, Roy.
Well, in David's case, one of his PiStars is running a DMR. The other is running DStar, which you can do. The way that Raspberry Pi works is that unless you set it otherwise, it will look for a DHCP server. And usually, as Lou mentioned, the router usually plays that part, although I have servers that are capable of running DHCP implementations. And what that does is it simply calls the network and it says, I need an IP that isn't being used. It sends back a packet with a unused IP address, and it has an age time where if it uses it for, say, more than 30 days, and that's what it's set for, it will give it a new IP address that isn't being used presently according to the DHCP server that's running. So it's perfectly legitimate that you could run without a static IP address. A lot of things are idiot-proof, and they just call for a random available IP address.
If he's not using the same, if he's not using both radios at the same time, why does he need more than one IP address unless he's going through the same PiStar program?
Well, he could be using, he's not necessarily transmitting on both, although maybe he is. He may just be receiving on both, and he has one hooked up to a DStar handy talkie, another one to a DMR, and he wants to have that availability, I guess.
But am I correct in what I just said, that if he assigns a static IP address to one hotspot, so let's say D-Star, and then another static IP address to DMR, for DMR, where would be the conflict at all? Go ahead.
There wouldn't be any conflict. I don't know where you kind of got the idea that we were talking about conflict. If you select the same static IP address, that's where you get the collision. That's why very often companies enable their software that runs their hardware to just kind of grab a dynamic IP, because that's pretty sure not going to have a collision. Whereas if they leave it to a random number of people to just assign their own static IPs, inevitably some of them are going to come up with the same exact IP address for two devices and wonder why their machines aren't working right.
Maybe I didn't understand his problem, but I guess the, I don't know, getting into DHCP addresses when you're running, I shouldn't talk, but when you're running two different protocols, could get a little messy. I guess it has already. So, but I would just think that he would, for the D-Star setup in Pi-Star, have one address, and for the DMR setup in Pi-Star, have another address, and go to it like that.
Yes, and if he chose the static IP address, that's the only place that you can enter a specific IP address. He's left the software to dynamically request IP addresses. And so every so often he'll get a refresh at a different IP address when he tries to run a web browser that's looking at the old IP address. He comes up blank, and he then has to use an IP sniffer to figure out where is the HTTP server that planted his PyStars for this time on what other IP address, so that he can get through it with a browser.
Okay, QSL, got it now. I've never had to solve that problem, but it shouldn't be too hard. D-Star with one radio and running DMR with another. So back to NET, W2BZ.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it's just a matter of choice. You choose whether you want to supply your own static IP address. You just have to make sure that it's not colliding with another device that you gave the same. Or you just leave everything to its own, and the DHCP server does its thing. The only thing you then have to be aware of, that your IP addresses might move over time, and have some method of tracking them down. That's all. So, I wish David well. Using a dynamic IP address is fine. A lot of people do that all the time. I just happen to like static IP addresses, but most manufacturers will give you the choice. Occasionally, where they feel that they know better than anyone else, they don't. But that's the nature of technology. Yes, comment.
Hey, thank you. I think it's very important to, like, the delineation between static and dynamic addresses to be resolved, because this can also be translated in the actual address that your hotspot will be touching the external network. It may not be the same as what's on your internal network. For me, I create a static range and I create a dynamic range. Static range are devices that I always want in service. Dynamic range might be something ephemeral, like a laptop or a cell phone. It may not always be on my network. So you can use this to connect devices that you want to rely on. You can also use it for devices that may not necessarily be there. And so setting up a device like that on static range is a good idea. The other thing is you can also use DHCP always assign the same IP address. That, I think that didn't need to be understood because it's a feature that's available in a lot of devices. It's really, really easy and easy to use feature and good to use.
Okay, thanks a lot. What's your first name?
Sorry about that. This is KD2TNS. My name is Matt.
Okay, very good, Matthew. I've seen you in the chat room, so I'm glad to hear you in person. Yeah, you make a good point. The problem, though, is all DHCPs are not created equal. So some are much more feature-rich than others. I know personally, although I use way too many electronic devices with way too many IP addresses, I don't come close, thankfully, to 256 IP addresses. So what I tend to do is I have the DHCP set for about 20 or 30 IP addresses in a row, and I use the ones that aren't in that range for my static addresses. And I just tend to like to have the static addresses set for local use. But again, it's going to be a weird world when I finally have more than 256 IP devices in my room, in my shack, in my house.
Yes, absolutely. And also, it's also good to mention that this is we're talking about IPv4. There's also IPv6, which that's a complicated thing. I won't get into that. But you are right. Many devices have various levels of support for this. I found most modern devices can very easily assign static or at least persistent addresses over for given ranges. And that's the easiest solution. I know most Netgear devices can do this. I know there's a couple other brands that can do it as well. So it just all depends on your use case. I mean, obviously I have networking gear that is a little more complex. So I guess it just depends on your use case, as you mentioned.
Someone broke in with a comment. Do you want to comment again with a little bit less noise?
Bravo Zulu again, Roy.
Yes, Rich. Yes, Rich, please.
Now that I'm clearing up after my now fifth computer crash, I finally found a Windows 10 disk that worked, and it just crashed on me. I'm wondering, and I'll ask this question later, if it could be a voltage, some kind of voltage change to the power supply. But anyway, as far as I know, PiStar asks for a static IP address that matches up with the IP address that's stored in your wireless router. And all you do is click a button in PiStar, and all of a sudden you're on a different network. Am I missing something here, or do I have the questioner's question correct? Go ahead.
I'm not 100% sure. It's my understanding, and a very quick Google of PiStar mentions that there is a dynamic IP assignment, and you can switch it over to a static. So if your PiStar has been configured to a static IP address, I guess it might ask what address you want it to be statically identified as. If it's set for a dynamic, it probably doesn't ask. It just goes to the DHCP server. Now, if it's set to do dynamic IP addressing and there's no DHCP server in your network, then it probably comes back and says, where do you want this IP to go?
Okay, QSL. Well, to show myself, I didn't even know that PiStar gave you the choice of the dynamic IP address.
Well, like I always say, Google is our friend, and apparently there's a whole bunch of posts about static IP addresses and dynamic IP addresses when it comes to PiStar. stuff. Most equipment that does kind of default to a dynamic IP addresses very often will give you the option of requesting a constant specific IP address, and by that very nature of the definition, that's a static IP address. So, it does not at all surprise me that BiStar has that capability as well.
One last thing, I don't know if I just learned that Brandmeister will require passwords for everybody, unique passwords, their own password, to get on the network starting, I heard, next week. And the way you do it is, I don't know the exact particulars, but extra page and follow along with the instructions, but you do need a unique password from now on. Go ahead.
Okay, I mean, that's reasonable. I'm sure there's a lot of lazy people out there who either set their passwords to blank or passwords, so I guess they're just implementing more security. I mean, ultimately, I don't exactly know what kind of damage you could do if you had someone's password. You could link and unlink their hotspots. That's about as much as I can imagine that you could do.
I don't know, but today they had on Sundays, they have their international check-ins, and it lasted 3 hours from all over the world. People were checking in from all over the world, so I guess it's getting to the point where they do need some security. Maybe the bad guys have found something out or whatever, but it's growing exponentially. Back to death.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that it's popular. Again, other than just hijinks, it's not like they're going to steal your credit card account, your security number, or do identity fraud. It's more of wreaking pranks and such. So it's reasonable. I mean, it's always a good idea that people use decent passwords for security. Every so often they'll issue a publication of the 10 most overused passwords, where inevitably a lot of people use the word password as a password. A lot of people use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. They use God. They use all kinds of common, consistent things. And that's not a great idea. I kind of live in fear of websites that require you to change your password every 30, 60, or 90 days. I understand the added security. I think that's somewhat self-defeating in that if you make people change a very obscure password too often that isn't kind of regulated with some kind of hardware token, then inevitably you'll get a bunch of guys who write it down on Post-it notes and stick it on their monitor, which doesn't strike me as terribly secure.
GNS, come.
Yes, please, come.
All right, GNS. I am a security professional, and I deal with password rotation and things like that all the time. I think the best advice anyone could hear these days is use a password manager. Most everyone has a phone that can run that. Most everyone has a computer that where they would need to log into things can run one too. And fundamentally, if you can remember your password, it's not secure enough. The other thing is, always make sure you never use the same password. You have to use a different password for everything. That's more important than rotating. And the idea is that the compromise of a password on one service, if you use the same password somewhere else, it could be a problem, because it might be compromised. So the whole point is to make sure you use a different password for everything, and that's why a password manager is so important.
And I agree with you. I use them myself. They unfortunately are not perfect. I have found that the one that I use, I think what it's called, Robo something, Robo Help, It doesn't really sync well between different devices, and it generates redundant root directories, and some of the root directories have more of my passwords than others. So on one device, I might have the password, and on another device, I don't have the password. But I agree with you that the two good things are these applications, especially if they work across all kinds of different devices, and also these security token keys. Either they use them through USB ports, or they use them through near-field devices. Those are useful too.
Yeah, personally I use YubiKey, which is a USB type device, quite often. I also use Nearfield myself. And I do think there is like a good challenge, and especially, you know, within the computer security community, it's hard to make it easily usable. It's hard to make everything functional for all the types of systems you want to use. But I always encourage people to at least try, and at the very minimum, use different passwords. I know it's not always all that easy to do that, but it's just a key thing that I always bring up, and I always feel like I've got to harp on this, unfortunately. So, that's what I'm saying about that.
Well, Matthew, I appreciate your professional in the field. It's always good to listen to professionals. I still, unfortunately, in my mind's eye, especially when I come to websites, and when it comes to medical stuff, they get a really anal retentive about security. So a lot of medical software requires changing your password repeatedly, and using as obscure things that it's kind of difficult to memorize. So every time I see that, I say to myself, somewhere out there is a guy scribbling on a post-it note and putting it on his monitor.
Yeah, I totally understand that. And with things like HIPAA regulations, you have to have that password rotation. There's all sorts of different regulations that require that professional capability. In a personal capability, you don't have to rotate it as much. You get a lot more safety by simply using the password manager and making very, very unique passwords. When it comes to professional use, it depends on your organization. And hey, I'm right there with you, like I'm sure many people are, having to change my passwords every 30 days for, you know, no apparent reason. It's challenging. Like, there's no perfect sense of security. You just need to make it harder, more difficult. You have to increase the entropy to the point where cracking your password becomes not easily viable. And that's really the point, is to increase the difficulty. And tools like password managers make it easier for you to increase the difficulty for people, but also make it more seamless and easier for you as opposed to a person to manage.
Move along. We'll move along soon, sir, whoever you may be out there. And you should really ID yourself, especially if you have an opinion about something. But just touching before we do move along, that's kind of the same idea that that locksmithing is built upon. For the most part, locks do not keep people out who really want to get in. What locks tend to do is make it more difficult to get into your house than your neighbor's house. So I agree with you. It's you want to make it not cost effective. Find other places to break into rather than yourself. It just strikes me as somewhat bizarre that it's much easier to log into, say, a Fidelity account than it is to New York City to pay your real estate taxes. You know, I don't know exactly if some pirate breaks into my real estate tax payment account, what is he going to do? Pay my real estate tax? I kind of don't quite know. Okay, so we will once again move on. John, N2ZC, what's your question or topic tonight?
Yeah, thank you, Roy. As you may recall, we
focus length on the last TechNet. I have the Expert 2KFA, just got it probably a couple months ago, and I was getting reports of audio out like that, and another gentleman said it sounded like feedback, so it seemed like a few things might be going on, and let me just cut out for the repeater. And you had suspected that it may be some RF in the shack, which sounded really good, and I just wanted to get back to you on it. Thanks to two other hams, N2ERV and KA1TM, they stuck with me on the air, and due to their suggestions, we tried something, which was, even though the linear was hooked up via ALC, I manually backed down the output power out of the Yaesu FT950. And lo and behold, even on high power then, with the power backed down, the 2KFA wanted 60 watts of drive, and when I backed it down to, let's say, about 40, all of the distortion, all of the clipping, everything was gone. And let me just unkey. So I called the people over at Expert, and of course they told me there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with their amp and that it's RFI, which it very well may be, very well may be. But I just want to get your opinion. You know, is it, these two other gentlemen felt that the amp was just simply being overdriven, and it did cure the problem. But let me hear from the big wigs here. What do you think? Where should we go with this now? November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Well, my experience, is, as I mentioned before, is primarily the Expert 1.3KFA, which is pretty much very, very, very similar. Has a slightly different module. I think the last few runs of the 1.3 use the same 1.5 kilowatt power module. My device, as I mentioned before, you can actually, I don't use the ALC to power it. It has an internal ability to kind of sense its own output power, and you can tweak the amount of driven power. You know, it has a feedback loop to the CIV. And what I did was I turned it up, and I set it up too high, and I immediately got an alarm, and I slowly set it lower and lower and lower until I didn't get an alarm, and I ended up on high with something like 1,245 or 60, something like that, and that's where I locked it down. So I actually physically checked the settings for this linear at the different bands and tweaked and adjusted the feedback settings rather than use the ALC. So maybe there's something a little wonky with the ALC.
Okay, so at this point, I would imagine until, you know, nothing's ever 100% resolved until it goes away for a while. But if I'm understanding you and feeling you here, at this point you're kind of figuring it's an overdrive rather than an RFI pulling back. Would that be correct?
Well, it could be either. It certainly could be an overdrive, although, again, in my past experiences with my linear, it squeals like a pig if you give it too much power. I would assume if yours was working well and correctly, it also has that overdrive alarm. And, again, when you get to the program setting, you can, you know, the set button and such, you can kind of adjust the output going through it and see if you can get the warning to come on. It really should. It's also possible that at a certain high enough power, you have just enough common mode radiation that gets into your microphone cord and screws up your transmitter. That's a possibility as well.
This is the reason why I lean more towards an overdrive, is that I can get this distortion or clipping or feedback, you know, whatever it may be, even on low power. But when I reduce the drive that the amp wants, and again, talking expert, it's 20 on low, 40 mid, and 60 on high. When I reduce it off what it wants, I can go to high and not even have that distortion. So, to me, I'm leaning towards the amp itself. It may not be doing anything to set off an alarm, but, you know, between the type of rig I'm using or maybe, you know, the Yaesu, whatever it may be, it just is overdriving it. And again, you know, I'm still open to it being a RF in the shack also.
Okay. I mean, have you taken a look at the manual and seen how the CAT interface works and how you can tweak the power settings for the different bands? You might want to kind of work a little bit on that and see if you could optimize how that's set.
Now, that was the second thing I was going to ask you. Can I use the ALC and actually program it so it doesn't call for so much power? Is that possible through either the linear or from the rig?
Well, again, I usually have not used the ALC to control that. I use the other settings in the expert system to kind of tweak down the drive power. It has the ability to figure out what kind of drive is going into it, and it can send a signal back to the transmitter to lower the signal. So that's pretty much the only way that I've been using my expert linear amplifier.
So if I'm understanding you correct, and this is news to me, I do have the CAT going directly into the linear, and it's I thought that was only to track the frequency. But if I'm understanding you correctly, that can also adjust the power on its own. Is that correct?
Yep, that's what it does on my Flex. I set it for a different settings, and it resets my radio to an acceptable output level.
Now, Roy, when you say Flex, are you talking about a program then that you're using in between? I've heard of Flex. I'm not familiar with it, though.
No, my primary radio has been a Flex or a radio 6700. So I set the CAT command for Flex, and then I go into the settings and adjust the power settings for the different bands and the different power levels.
On the linear itself, then?
Yes, the linear, God bless it, does that all by itself. As long as it has a setting for the CAT to the particular radio that you're using.
Okay, very good, very good. And I just have two other questions related, slightly off this, but definitely related to it. The last one on this is, what do you think of actually putting a potentiometer in the CAT? Is that a possibility in the CAT where I could just fix it? Because, again, I'm just looking to get something lower out of there where I could just put a potentiometer that would just reduce the voltage or raise it, whatever it is, because I think it runs on a negative voltage by, you know, 25% or 30%. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. That kind of strikes me as an interesting number of ways that could go terribly wrong. There's a lot of arguments back and forth, especially on the Internet, about whether ALC is all it's cracked up to be. There's a lot of people who are kind of disenchanted with using that as either using it at all, or some people advise to just use it as an emergency brake. So to make fine adjustments based on an external potentiometer, it's possibly possible to do. Again, it seems like a dangerous kludge to me personally. There might be guys out there who have played the games like that with the ALC.
Yeah, I kind of was a little leery of it myself, but I'm going to put it out there. I just to advance it. Now, I'm going to also do something about RF and see what happens with that. Let me ask you a quick question. There's so much information out there about chokes, and a lot of it is contradictory. I don't have to tell you, like many things in amateur service theories, etc. These quote-unquote ugly balloons or open air chokes. Have you have any experience with them? And if you did, did you find they work well?
Well, yeah. I mean, they do work reasonably well. There are some limitations. The so-called ugly choke. The air choke is basically just taking about 6 feet of cable and coiling it together, kind of clamping it down with some plastic straps or something. Some people put a cardboard tube to just kind of keep it in a coiled position. You just have to make sure of the coax cable that you're using is capable of being used at the turn angles that you're using, because if it's too tight for that design of coax, you can dislodge the center feed off to a side and change the impedance and kind of upset all of it. But if you have a coax that's capable of tight turns, it works. I tend to like the W2DU, which again is just basically five nice hefty ferrite clamps one after the other, and then I seal it all in a piece of larger shrink tubing. You could also take the coax and a toroid of ferrite material and loop the coax around the toroid, again, as long as the coax is designed for that degree of curvature. And that will also increase the impedance, which is what you're trying to do with a RF choke.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I put that coil on my 80-meter dipole. It's thin coax, though. It's RG58. So, it's very easy to do that. It's about 8 inches in diameter. I do about five turns, and I use the plastic ties. Years ago, I never realized they had UV plastic ties, and they would pop off. And so, that was a problem. But once I realized they had UV ties, then no problem. It's been up there like forever. So, I find it more effective.
Yeah, they work, and especially RJ58 is supple enough that you can make really tight turns. It becomes a little bit more arduous if you're doing it with LMR 400. That really doesn't take quite the narrow turns. And also, if you figure out the cost of, 5 or 6 feet of LMR 400, it's probably cheaper to slap some ferrite rather than go to the trouble of coiling that monster around somewhere. RG58 lends itself a lot to that. But just about anything that increases the inductive impedance, be it helical coils of the coax or repeated turns inside a ferrite torus, or multiple ferrite clamps on the surface of coax. The wool serves the same purpose.
What's your thought on RG8X for that type of balance?
RG8X is thinner than LMR 400, and you could probably get away with using that as well. I mean, but there are guys who do it with LMR 400. It's just more of a pain in the backside.
Okay, and since this is the tech net, let me ask you something. This really bothered me. Everything I always knew about coils and chokes was that when a current passes through a coil, as it passes through, it induces a current in the coil that is a counter EMF that opposes the flow of current. And I was always very comfortable with that. That's what I was taught, and, you know, made perfect sense. You're inducing a current in the coil, which now opposes that current and chokes it off. Now, all of a sudden, I'm being presented with a situation where I'm trying to prevent these backflow of currents here, these common mode currents, but I would have assumed that it would have also impeded the RF going. Why is that not? It almost sounds like it's working like a diode in a sense, that it's not impeding or doesn't impede to some degree the RF out. And, you know, and more so on the RF back.
John, the secret to that is the difference between differential mode current and what's going on with common mode current. The differential mode current that's running up to your antenna is two opposing currents inside the coaxial cable. The sum current between the two differential currents is zero, so when it gets to the inductor, it induces nothing. The common mode, on the other hand, is a single current going in one direction. It does induce a current in the impedance, in the inductor, and blocks common mode current. It also would block any kind of common mode RF. But the point of the exercise is that when you're transmitting RF to your antenna and you get reflected power back, you're sending differential mode power current and you're getting back common mode, which is amenable to impedance blocking.
Thank you, Roy. That was a very nice explanation. And, you know, you can read things sometimes and it just doesn't sink in. And so what I'm hearing you correctly is that the differential mode, actually, since they're both equal, they're almost, or they are rather, canceling each other through the coil and therefore not setting up a counter EMF. Am I understanding that correct?
Yes, indeed. That's exactly what's going on. As far as the inductor, as far as that ferrite toroid is concerned, there is no net current being sent because the two oppose each other, cancel each other out locally. And if you want to think about it, transmission lines should be differential mode transmission lines, but antennas, the actual radiating antenna, you could think of that as a common mode transmission line.
Gotcha. Very interesting. Thank you. Cleared it up. And of course, with questions comes more questions. So I'm going to give you the last one. If I made the balun, if I'm running RG8X, if I made the balun with LMR 400, would there be any kind of conflict there with impedance? I think they're both 50 ohm impedance, but they are different cable. Or would you just make the balun with the RG8X?
I don't really see any particular benefit in changing the type of cable, especially in that direction. What a lot of people tend to do is they'll have regular LMR 400 runs from their tower to their shack, but when you get up to the rotor for a rotating antenna, they will have a jumper made out of a more flexible coax like Ultraflex or even a smaller size, more flexible coax. So I would keep it the same under the circumstances that you mentioned. I've heard people for some weird reason think that velocity factor is important in these cases. If you have two different coaxes that have the same impedance, they might have a different velocity factor, but